You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 6th of November, 2013, on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London, and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Nancy Durham. On today's show, from Geneva and Cairo to Pakistan and Bethlehem, we'll review the day's top stories with Zainia Dormandy and Shashank Joshi. Then we'll head to Hollywood to dig into the film industry's controversial relationship with the Nazis during World War II.
The Nazi German consul in Los Angeles was routinely invited to studio lots and would be screened movies. He would tell studio heads what scenes they needed to cut if they wanted to keep their German business.
And we'll stay in the world of film. This time we tour the Burkina Faso cinema scene with the producer of the new film, Afrikaan.
I thought we'd make a great series of films, actually, if we went out there and spoke to filmmakers, interviewed them, filmed the festival. But we didn't actually think this would be a feature documentary. We thought we'd bring back all this material and show it in different episodes on Highbrow.
All that plus some music and a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Nancy Durham, starting right now. So lots coming up over the next hour here on Aperitivo. But first, let's start off with Bill Bingham and the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. The widow of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is claiming her husband was poisoned to death in 2004 with radioactive polonium. Suha Arafat says the results of Swiss forensic tests on her husband's body reveal what she calls a real crime, a political assassination. A team of experts, some of them from Lausanne University Hospital's Institute of Radiation Physics, opened Mr. Arafat's grave in the West Bank city of Ramallah last November and took samples from his body. At the time of his death, a post-mortem revealed he'd had a massive stroke, but doctors said they were unable to find the origin of his illness. At least seven people have been killed by an explosion in the center of the Syrian capital, Damascus. The Sana State News Agency says 50 people have been injured by the blast in Hejaz Square. Eight people were also killed in a rare blast in Suweida. The town, which is home to Syria's Druze minority, is under government control and has been mostly free of violence. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has pledged an extra $75 million to help Palestinians on his visit to the Middle East to join peace talks. The aid is designed to boost Palestinian public support for the faltering negotiations and is intended to create jobs and improve roads, schools and other infrastructure. The announcement followed meetings between Mr. Kerry and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as part of attempts to overcome the many problems hindering the talks. Mr. Kerry also met Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank and warned negotiations will not be easy.
As in any negotiation, there will be moments of up and moments of down, and it goes back and forth. But I can tell you, President Obama and I are determined to try to bring lasting peace to the people of this region. The Palestinian economy will not be built on foreign aid alone. It will be built on the hard work and the entrepreneurship of the Palestinian people, and it would be built on the foundation of a politically arrived at peace.
A court in Islamabad has issued a written order for the release of former President Pervez Musharraf. The Sessions Court had granted him bail on Monday in the murder case of the cleric Abdul Rashid Ghazi and his mother, and ordered two surety bonds amounting to around $2,000 be paid. The former president was arrested last month over the murders during an operation on the Red Mosque in 2007. General Musharraf has been under house arrest in his farmhouse in Islamabad, which has been declared a sub-jail. His lawyer, Ahmed Raza Kasuri, says he's now a free man.
Once he is released, which will be done at any moment, he will be a free person. He can move around within the country. As soon as the orders of the court for his release from the Red Mosque case will reach, the result will be that his house would cease to be a sub-jail and would revert back to its original position as a private residence of General Musharraf.
Raffaella Sollecito has denied murdering Meredith Kircher and begged an Italian jury to be given his life back. Speaking 6 years after the British student was killed in Perugia, the 29-year-old made his dramatic plea to the appeal trial in Florence. During an emotional 15-minute speech, which followed a morning of complex DNA results, Mr. Sollecito described his brief romance with co-defendant Amanda Knox as a little fairy tale. Colombian FARC rebel leaders and government negotiators have agreed on a political future for the left-wing group should a peace deal be reached. At the continuing talks in Cuba, both sides agreed on guarantees, conditions, and support for the creation of new political parties. Colombia's largest rebel group and the government have yet to discuss another 4 items on the agenda. The peace talks aim at bringing an end to nearly 50 years of armed conflict. The levels of gases in the atmosphere that drive global warming increased to a record high in 2012. According to the World Meteorological Organization, atmospheric CO2 increased more rapidly last year than its average rise over the past decade. Concentrations of methane and nitrous oxide also broke previous records. The WMO says the warming effect on our climate has increased by almost a third since 1990 due to carbon dioxide and the other gases. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill, and you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We'll be right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Aperitivo. The time here in London is 18:07 and it's 13:07 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news, I'd like to welcome Zania Dormandy, Project Director for the U.S. Program at Chatham House, and Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, or RUSI. Welcome to both of you to the program.
Good evening.
Great to be here.
How are you?
Very good. How are you?
I'm well, too, and very glad to see you in here to warm up our studio with
Absolutely.
Some interesting talk. Let's dive right into the Middle East, if we could, speaking of warm. The U.S. Secretary Kerry is pulling out all the stops he can, it seems, to try to get a Palestinian-Israeli agreement. He resurrected the talks after a 3-year break some months ago. What do you think?
I'm not optimistic. I mean, you know, this is a personal view, of course. He's putting in an awful lot of political weight and will. I guess there's 3 parts to it. There's do the Israelis want an agreement? The longer this goes on for, the more the Israelis are worried that by not having agreement, actually you're changing the demographics within Israel. So there, actually, the situation for them is getting worse over time in the sense that there are more Palestinians being born in Israel than there are Israeli Jews being born in Israel. And so that this is a problem for them. But it's a very, very slow change. The Palestinians don't appear to really want an agreement because they have a split Hamas Fatah, thank you. Hamas Fatah. So there's problems there about getting agreement and you're being squeezed on the right and the left. And then in the US, it's unclear whether, even though Kerry is using an awful lot of political will to move forward, it's unclear whether this is really a priority of President Obama. This cannot be done without a US presidential weight behind it and political weight behind it. And it's so I think on each side, it's dubious how much people will play and sacrifice, and therefore I think it's unlikely, but I applaud the effort.
Well, I think it's a foreboding omen that on the same day we're discussing this, the Swiss authorities have found that Yasser Arafat's body contains vast amounts of polonium, which I'm sure is a sort of an inapt metaphor for the entire thing. I do think you talked about presidential authority. If there is one thing this process does have, I think it is presidential authority at this point. We saw Obama's UN speech fail to mention Asia once. I think he mentioned China once, India 0 times. What he did mention was the Israel-Arab peace process, and he mentioned Syria and Iran. But he clearly authorized and encouraged Kerry to pursue this and make it one of his top two priorities alongside the Iranian nuclear dispute. That kind of high-level attention helps. It has to go beyond the level of people like Martin Indyk, who were initially running the process, for this to go anywhere. So that's step one. I think the other positive sign is it survived a pretty tumultuous period. We've just seen a major change of government in Egypt, which has real sway amongst Palestinian factions, away from Morsi towards the army. Real tumult there, violence in the Sinai, rockets going into Israel. The process is still going. And I think as long as it keeps going on, even a small amount of hope is better than what we had before.
The only thing I would add to that is, as it was clear, I'm less optimistic than you, but I agree with your conclusion that any kind of progress, you know, any kind of conversation is a very, very important kind of minimal level of engagement. So as long as there's a conversation going on, we should encourage that. We should hope. But as I say,
in some ways, this is a classic end of, you know, my final term ritualistic attempt at a peace process. It has to be done. The motions have to be gone through.
And you have to give Obama credit that actually in the beginning of his first term, this was something he focused on. So he did actually focus on it early and then gave up. Effectively,
yes.
And there's a refer. I don't
was
think
rebuffed,
he's.
I think
exactly. I don't think he's given quite as much authority to Kerry as you lay out. But you know, that's in the margins.
Is Netanyahu in for this at all? Do you think what's he doing announcing 3,500 homes for Jewish settlers in the occupied territories?
It's a giant middle finger to the United States, and it's a rather awful way to treat the U.S. Secretary of State on his arrival. The most charitable interpretation one could muster is that this is his way of protecting his right flank at home. We often forget, I think, for Netanyahu's bravado and obnoxious rhetoric at times, he does not represent the far right of his country. There are those who are chomping from the other side, and this is a way of buying himself space and buying himself the freedom of maneuver he needs. But beyond that, I think it's a profoundly unhelpful step.
I concur totally. I mean, I don't think there's anything to add there. It's you just have to remember that in each of these countries, it's not just one side that the leaders are protecting themselves against. It's both. In the States, you know, you have a very strong Israeli lobby, you know, Jewish lobby in the U.S. that is putting pressure on Obama to be more gentle, particularly given the negotiations going on in Iran. If he's going to give on Iran, does he have to, you know, give something on Israel as well? You know, you have the same kind of factions, you know, Fatah Hamas factions in the Palestinian side. And, you know, as you mentioned, you've got the same kind of factions on the Israeli side.
You mentioned, Shawshank, the poisoning story that's just broken about Arafat.
Yes.
It is, ironic's not the word, but what timing for this?
Well, it's not the first time the poisoning story has come out. I mean, Arafat, of course, was irrelevant at the time of his death. I personally find it exceptionally difficult to imagine why anyone would wish to kill him. But I think what is interesting is just how different the Middle East Palestinian environment looks today than it did during Arafat's day, because the major obstacle here, or one of the major obstacles, as Enya pointed out, is this huge split between the West Bank, Fatah-run West Bank, and the Hamas-run Gaza Strip. Now, the one thing we should point out is that some Hamas representatives have said they would recognize any peace outcome that the Fatah-run authorities agreed, but that has to be tested. We have to test them with actions.
And every time they say they're going to work together, they then split up. I mean, you know, we have, you know, regularly every year or so an announcement that Fatah and Hamas have agreed to have a joint this, that and the other. And then it, you know, falls at the first hurdle. So, again, one has to be a little dubious about their ability to bring the parties on board, which is something that can be said for many other countries in the Middle East as well.
Let's see if we can bring perhaps a little more optimism, maybe, to this next topic beyond Israel and Palestine. We've got a resumption of the nuclear talks tomorrow in Geneva with the UN permanent five countries, that's US, Russia, China, France and the UK and Germany on one side and then Iran on the other. So they're back after just a very short break.
Incredibly short. Don't forget,
just a couple of
the
weeks,
fact
right?
that they're back is itself significant. When you had negotiations in prior years, even at Almaty last year, it took days just to agree on a place and time for the next round of negotiations. These were agreed really fast in New York, in Geneva when they last met, and there were months between meetings. So the fact that negotiations have now been compressed on this schedule, that's good news, by the way.
It means they've got something cooking?
Well, I'm not sure about cooking. I mean, I know the Foreign Minister Javad Zarif said we might reach an agreement this week, but I wouldn't pay too much attention to that. I think it's a sign that they are getting on the same page, which means something can start cooking.
Zania.
I agree. I'm turning out to be the pessimistic one here, which is not normally my place, but nevertheless, I'll take it. I'm made a little nervous by Zarif's comment about this week. One of the things that I think has been very, very positive about these latest round of negotiations on the Iran nuclear situation is the fact that they've said none of this is public. We're not talking about any of the conversations. We're not talking about any of the detail. This is a very private negotiations. And only once we've kind of finished this process will we actually go out public. That's a very, very positive sign, because it leaves the negotiators, the diplomats, space to test out things, to kind of feel waters, to explore without getting themselves having to defend that publicly to various different factions. On the other hand, you know, we saw back in Ungar in September, when this was kind of first starting to blossom, you know, huge expectations. Suddenly people said, well, will they, you know, will there be a handshake between Obama and, you know, will there be and Rouhani and, you know, and then there was a telephone call and everybody
tweet.
Got very, exactly, there was a tweet. There was a telephone call. You know, everybody got very enthusiastic. And those expectations aren't terribly helpful. And so when the Iranian negotiator kind of comes out saying we could have an answer this week, that makes me nervous, because you end up putting extra pressure on the negotiators that frankly isn't needed. That being said, moving that aside, I am actually quite optimistic about this. I'm cautiously optimistic.
There is a considerable amount, well, we don't know what's going on because of the secrecy, but fuzziness around. We have the Iranians saying we want to be more transparent, but in exchange, they want to see the sanctions beginning to be lifted. But
the devil is all in the detail. You know, everyone knows what a nuclear settlement looks like at this point. In the end, Iran would be allowed to enrich some uranium, contrary to the various demands made by the UN Security Council.
Although there are many in the United States that say that that's a red line, and in Israel that say, I mean, I agree with
you,
that's going to be the answer.
There are many who say that will never happen, but I will eat my hat if there's no deal that doesn't involve Iran enriching. And on the other side, Iran will have to export lots of its uranium, shut down lots of its facilities, curb its enrichment capacity. All the devil here is in the detail. And I think that's what we need to see tested. But I will say, don't expect a big bang. Expect an interim deal, which sets the process going. And once Obama can point to Iranian actions and said, look, in exchange for Europeans doing this or that, perhaps lifting a bit of their sanctions, the Iranians have moved, he will then be in a better place to persuade Congress to follow likewise. This won't begin with a big grand bargain where they all hug, make up, and everything sorted in a week.
The only two things I would add to that is, one is, you know, look for, you know, we hate this expression, but it's a nice segue from the earlier topic, look for a roadmap. It's going to be you do this, we do that, you do this, we do that. There's going to be a lot of trust building in this process, and there has to be a lot of trust building. Again, like the earlier topic, the peace process, you have to recognize that there are huge factions and both sides are dealing with their own factions. On the Iranian side, you have some real hawks. And so, you know, Rouhani is going to have to deal with the hawks within the system as well as the doves. On the US side, you also have to recognize, I mean, Congress just instituted a whole new set of sanctions.
Or began the bill in motion.
Exactly, put the bill in motion.
But on the Iranian side, what's interesting is you have almost an exact parallel with Iran's parliament having to ratify, if it's ever introduced as part of negotiations, something called the Additional Protocol, which means that Iran has to subject itself to more intrusive inspections. Well, Iran's parliament has to ratify that and agree to that, just as the US Congress has to agree to the lifting of these various rounds of sanctions.
But what can happen? I mean, this is what's the interesting in the detail. And sorry, then we'll move on, which is the US Congress has to agree to the lifting of the sanctions. But the president does have the authority to do a temporary lift on sanctions. So the president can say, you've done this and this and this, and therefore I am authorizing. Now, it's politically dangerous for him, but he can do it. I'm authorizing a lift of this
sanction. A little something
before he actually has to take it for the authority, full authority of Congress.
Okay. Just let's pause for a second there, just for a very short break. You're listening to Aperitivo with me, Nancy Durham. When we return, Zania and Shawshank will still be here, I think, and we're going to head to Cairo.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the Global Pulse.
I was at a Bunga Bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. The guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Well, I say welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, but we were listening to that break. Still with me is Zania Dormandy, Project Director for the US Program at Chatham House, and Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow of the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI. And Zania, you did your ears perked up at the sound of plum suede loafers? Were they loafers?
Plum suede loafers. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, how can you say no to something like that?
But you thought they weren't for you.
Yeah.
You're wearing a bit of plum on top there. I think you, and you're a runner, I hear.
I am a runner. I do not have plum running shoes, and I do not want plum. Isn't there a Dr. Seuss book? I do not want plum suede loafers. I do not want green eggs and ham.
There is now.
I do not want them.
Joshi, what have you got on your feet?
I'm afraid I've got boots. Practical boots for the rain.
Very good boots. Very.
Yeah. They are Swedish.
This not really plum, but maybe an exaggerated hint. Okay, well, enough fun.
How do we get from that to Egypt? I'm waiting for the lead in there.
I think plums are prolific, probably in some sort of drink there. Possibly.
I'm sure they are.
I don't
yes.
know. To Egypt now we go, where the Muslim Brotherhood has lost its bid to overturn the ban against it. It was in place since July following the army takeover. So the ban was put in place to prevent violence. Did it work at all?
Well, it's a bit of a protection racket, isn't it? If you go topple an elected president, albeit an authoritarian one, by force, and then slaughter his supporters, and then insist that you're banning the party to stop violence, I mean, it strikes me like a classic mafia tactic. And I'm afraid that's how I see this current army-backed interim government in Egypt. Really, it wants to squeeze the Brotherhood out of politics, in fact, out of Egypt completely. It may succeed in the short term, but I'm afraid this is no solution. We've seen this movie before. It will only lead to more violence, and I struggle to see how Egypt will have stable, widely accepted elections without the party that won the last ones.
Indeed.
Yeah. I 100% agree. You know, you've got, you know, what, if nothing else, what recent, the last couple of years have shown us is that what you need is a comprehensive, inclusive system. You know, Mubarak, that was certainly not inclusive. Morsi, certainly not inclusive. And that's kind of what, in very large part, brought him down. You've now got Sisi and the military, also not inclusive. Until you actually find a system which includes the various different principal factions within Egypt. And you have to remember, the election actually was a fairly close in some respect.
Yes.
I mean, there were multiple factions, all of which got significant portions of the vote. That means you actually have to bring these people in, you know, whether you end
but
up with a government.
Particularly when you always have to do that when the rules of an emerging democracy are so vague
yes.
and are still being contested. You know, if you start playing with the rules to increase your majority artificially, as Morsi did, that's a problem. It will naturally provoke resistance. But the same goes for the military.
Absolutely.
If you change the rules to squeeze out your opponents, or worst, of course, just machine gun them, as has been occurring over the past 2 months, again, that is equally unacceptable.
How does that lesson get learned?
Well, does it get learned? I mean, Zane and I, you and I are both watchers of South Asia, and we've watched a Pakistan army over 40, 50 years usurp various democratic governments. Does it ever learn that it should stay out of politics? It can only be squeezed out, as we've seen in Turkey. I'm afraid, look at places like Algeria. Did they learn that curbing Islamists and causing a civil war was a good idea in the 90s?
I have to disagree with you. I do think people learn, and you know, to take Pakistan as an example, you know, Pakistan has gone in and out of a democracy for 50 years. Have the Pakistanis learned anything? Yes. Has the Pakistani military learned something? Well, General Kiani appears to have learned something. He actually stepped back and pulled the military out of politics. So do I think people learn? Yeah, I do think people learn. But I think it's you know, like your mother always told you, you know, wouldn't it be lovely to learn from your parents' mistakes rather than making them yourself? No, the answer is you have to make them yourself almost always. The problem here is the consequences of making the mistakes yourself is, as we know, thousands of people being killed, machine gunned, et cetera, et cetera.
Will you take us to Pakistan? And we're going to talk about what might be a mistake there. Last week, we saw the killing of the Pakistani Taliban leader, Hakimullah Massoud, by a drone, just at that delicate moment when Pakistan seemed to be on the verge of talks with the Taliban. Now, Imran Khan, the politician, former cricketer, is threatening to cut off the supply lines through Pakistan to NATO forces in Afghanistan if the U.S. doesn't stop the drones by November 20th. So just a few days to go.
Well, I mean, I can tell you, the U.S. is not going to stop the drones. You know, I mean, just fact of life. So, you know,
they have paused them before in response to Pakistani grievances,
and they've decreased them significantly over the last year, and that should be recognised. But you know, is there a quasi solution which says the U.S. now only uses drones with the, and I, you know, you can't see me doing this, but in inverted commas, with the permission of the Pakistani government? Well, we know that that's actually been done with the permission of the Pakistani government in previous occasions, but now actually let's make that explicit. Could that be a possible kind of solution to this problem? You know, can Imran Khan, I know he controls the government in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, that the NATO forces have to go through, but can he actually stop it?
Well, can I just make two points? First of all,
please.
Imran Khan is a buffoon. You know, one of Pakistan's best columnists.
What do you really think?
He's a populist and idiotic buffoon. You know, he's a rabble-rouser, a populist. One of Pakistan's best columnists called him Taliban Khan the other day because he's essentially appeasing terrorists and mobilizing that constituency. But here's one thing more important. Zainia, you're right. Of course, NATO forces have to go through there, but they can also go through somewhere further to the south, Quetta, rather than Peshawar. Quetta is in Balochistan, much further south. Imran Khan does not control anything in Balochistan. So there are still routes for NATO to use. Just to be clear, this is not like when the federal government, Islamabad, blockaded NATO two years ago. This is a much narrower issue. The problem, of course, is the US now has to ship billions and billions of dollars of equipment out of Afghanistan. It's much cheaper to do most of it via the ground routes in Pakistan. So any reduction in capability, even if only one of the routes is shut, is going to mean the US has to fly more stuff out and get stuff more stuff out from the northern routes, Uzbekistan, Russia, which is a hell of a lot more expensive.
What about his complaint that this was a on purpose, deliberate targeting just at the moment of the talks beginning? Is that true?
Imran Khan's, his election campaign was all about negotiating with the Taliban. This is his issue, and he's been talking about it for, frankly, years. Nawaz Sharif came in and said, you know what, yeah, we do need to talk to the Taliban. That's an important part, and has been starting that process. Frankly, the Americans are going to get Massoud whenever they can get Massoud.
Clarify, the Pakistani Taliban, the organization that Massoud led, has conducted terrorist attacks against Americans. It sought to conduct the Times Square bombing. Against Pakistanis, against coalition troops in Afghanistan. This is also, I'm afraid, part of self-defense rationale.
Drones are here to stay for now.
As I say, the number of drones has decreased significantly. President Obama some months ago talked about having a kind of a new policy towards drones and a new set of kind of rules, if you will, processes by which they're going to be used. But yeah, drones are here to stay, not just from the US, but others.
And last week, the Pakistani Interior Ministry released figures showing remarkably that over the last 2 years, there have been zero civilian casualties from drones. Those are the Interior Ministry's own figures.
Hate to leave it there, but we have to. I want to thank you, Zainia Dormandy from Chatham House and Shashank Joshi from RUSI. Thanks so much for joining us here in Midori House.
You're welcome.
Pleasure.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's aperitivo. We'll head to the Monocle Cafe to talk film from Burkina Faso. We'll also look at Hollywood's relationship with Hitler, and we'll preview what's coming up on tonight's shows. But before we get started on all of that, here's Bill Bingham with the world news headlines.
Tests on his body have revealed former Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat may have been killed by radioactive polonium. A Swiss team was asked to examine samples taken from his corpse when his grave was exhumed last November. Now they say their tests moderately support the proposition that the death was the consequence of poisoning with polonium 210. At least seven people have been killed by an explosion in the centre of the Syrian capital, Damascus. The Sana State News Agency says 50 people have been injured by the blast in Hejaz Square. Eight people were also killed in a rare blast in the town of Suwayda. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has pledged an extra $75 million to help Palestinians on his visit to the Middle East to join peace talks. The aid is designed to boost Palestinian public support for the faltering negotiations and is intended to create jobs and improve roads, schools and other infrastructure. A court in Islamabad has issued a written order for the release of former President Pervez Musharraf. The Sessions Court had granted him bail on Monday in the murder case of the cleric Abdul Rashid Ghazi and his mother in 2007, and ordered two surety bonds amounting to around $2,000 be paid. Raffaella Sollicito has denied murdering Meredith Kercher and begged an Italian jury to be given his life back. Speaking 6 years after the British student was killed in Perugia, the 29-year-old made his dramatic plea to the appeal trial in Florence. The levels of gases in the atmosphere that drive global warming increased to a record high in 2012. According to the World Meteorological Organization, atmospheric CO2 increased more rapidly last year than its average rise over the past decade. Concentrations of methane and nitrous oxide also broke previous records. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. You're listening to Aperitivo live here on Monocle 24. The time now is 21:32 in Moscow. It's 18:32 here in London and 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to head to the Monocle Cafe on nearby Chiltern Street. Today we meet producer and Time Out's film editor Dave Calhoun. When Dave went to visit Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, to attend the largest film festival in Africa, FESPACO, he was so blown away by what he saw, he decided to make a film about it. The city hosts the festival's opening and closing ceremonies in a local football stadium, and 40,000 people attend. Calhoun's film is called Afrikan and will premiere at the Africa International Film Festival in Nigeria next week. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met Dave at the Monocle Cafe and asked him how he got involved with the production of this film.
Well, my day job is as a film critic and a film journalist, and I'm interested in African cinema, and I wanted to go out. I'd been to the FESPACO once before, and I suggested to a very good friend of mine, Don Boyd, who runs a website called highbrow.tv, which is a website for the arts based out of London, that we should go out there and film this festival, because I thought it would make a great series of films, actually, if we went out there and spoke to filmmakers, interviewed them, filmed the festival. But we didn't actually think this would be a feature documentary. We thought we'd bring back all this material and show it in different episodes on Highbrow.
Can you tell us more about the place where it takes? Because it's in Burkina Faso. It's quite a surprising location for the most famous cinema festival in Africa. You would presume it would be in South Africa or something like that.
It's true. It's not a hugely well-known country. Burkina Faso is landlocked. It's north of Ghana. It's I'm testing my geography here, but it's south of Mali. It's the reason why it's there, and it's been there as a festival since the late 60s, is, I'd say, partly to do with the very strong relationship between French cinema and African cinema, or specifically French cinema and Francophone, French-speaking cinema. And Burkina Faso has a long history of filmmaking as well, going back into the 50s and 60s. And out of that grew this, because Burkina Faso was producing interesting films in the 60s, this festival grew out of that. And it very quickly became, you know, the place where every 2 years, filmmakers from all over Africa wanted to take their films, show to other filmmakers, and also compete. It's like Cannes, you compete for the prize, which is known as is the wonderfully titled the Golden Stallion of Yenenga, is the main prize. It's the Fesbacco's equivalent of the Palme d'Or in Cannes.
And, let's talk a little bit about the films they show. I mean, as I said, is it only African films, or...?
They only show Africa films linked to Africa. So the main competition of films, you know, by African filmmakers that can include African filmmakers who are working outside of the continent, but mainly they're films from the African continent. It's definitely weighted towards Francophone Africa. So lots of films from West Africa. There are always, what I say, that the competition has about 20 films in it, the main competition, but two of those are usually from Burkina Faso themselves. Countries like Mali and Senegal, usually very well represented. There's usually something from South Africa. Also the Maghreb, Morocco, Tunisia and Egypt are also very well represented as well. It's interesting that there's certain countries, the countries where you actually see fewer films coming from are the countries which used to be British colonies. Yeah, English speaking. I think it's partly to do with the fact with the cultural legacy in those countries between them and, you know, the former colonial masters, so to speak. France continues to put money into cinema in Francophone Africa. So a lot of the films you see there are actually partly funded by the French government, which is itself an interesting thing. I mean, and arguably, and a lot of filmmakers do argue this, not a particularly healthy thing either. It's not a particularly self-sufficient cinema. But then you could probably say the same thing about British cinema and Hollywood, or, you know, and the dominance of American money in cinema around the world as well.
I guess Nollywood is not very popular in this festival, like for Nigeria, because it's quite a famous cinema industry there as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because at Fesbacco, they definitely take, I mean, the people that run the festival definitely take a more traditional conservative view of cinema. And Nollywood, I mean, as you say, I mean, Nigerian filmmaking shot on cheap cameras, straight to DVD, et cetera, et cetera, is a very popular cinema. It's very healthy in terms of, you know, people watching it. The people that run Fesbacco, firstly, actually, they demand that all the films that are shown in competition, certainly with the year I was there, are on 35mm, which immediately excludes a lot of filmmakers. I'd argue, and actually a lot of filmmakers at Fesbacco would argue, that it's probably time the festival moves on, really, and starts to embrace the digital world a bit more. It hasn't got there yet.
What's been your favourite films when you were there? And actually, can you remind us, which year have you been there?
Well, I was there, we made the film there in 2011. It takes place in February, late February 2011. And then I was there 4 years earlier in 2007. And in 2007, the film I remember the most was actually the film that won the Golden Stallion. It's a film from Nigeria called Ezra by a Nigerian filmmaker called Newton Aduaka, who raised in Nigeria, trained at the London Film School, and now lives in Paris. So he's actually a pretty good example of a lot of the filmmakers you meet at Fesbacco. They're fairly global. And Ezra was a story of child soldiers in an unnamed African country, but it definitely been inspired by the situation in Rwanda. Very, very hard-hitting realist drama about the experience of child soldiers. Sadly, didn't really have much of a life, this film, outside of... elsewhere in the world. I remember it showed at the London Film Festival. It certainly didn't receive UK distribution, and that's, to be honest, when you're in Fesbacco, it's easy to get incredibly excited about great work that you're seeing, but you do come back down to earth when you leave and you realise that so many of these works will not be seen in very many places beyond specialist African film festivals in cities around the world.
So how do you think African cinema is being portrayed outside Africa?
Well, I say Africa, I say that actually the fact that we talk about African cinema as one kind of homogenous unit like that suggests that there isn't very much of it, or there's certainly, or to put that another way, we're not very aware of it. I mean, I guess we talk about European cinema sometimes, we talk about South American, Latin American cinema, but I think very quickly we start talking about national cinemas often. You know, we start talking about French cinema, we're talking about Italian cinema or German cinema. If you were going to compare the numbers of films produced in Europe and Africa, I mean, the numbers are very, very low in Africa. Certain countries have healthy film industries, though. I mean, traditionally, South Africa produces a lot of films. Egypt does. Nigeria does as well. I mean, famously, Nollywood. But I think, not many films travel outside of Africa relatively each year. I mean, probably in London, top of my head, we'd probably be lucky actually if we saw, you know, two or three films getting mainstream distribution each year. And when I say mainstream distribution, I mean probably in two or three screens.
And that was Dave Calhoun, producer of the new film, Afrikaan, with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Well, we were just in Burkina Faso, so let's hear a bit of music now from neighboring Mali. This is Amadou and Mariam with the song Sabali. Amadou and Mariam, beautiful sounds there from them. They're from Mali, and that was Sabali. Up next, we're in Hollywood. Please stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And you're listening to Aperitivo with me, Nancy Durham. Given their propensity to influence thought and opinion, movies were a favorite pastime for many in Nazi Germany. But it was their leader who had a true passion for the silver screen. Hitler was known to watch a film every night. His propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels shared his enthusiasm. However, it seems that Hollywood bowed to Nazi Germany in order to maintain a foothold in the market. Hollywood studios agreed not to make movies that attacked and condemned the Nazis. Author Ben Erwant takes a close look at what went on behind the scenes in his new book, The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with Hitler. Ben joined Monocle's Phil Hahn and Tig Enright in the studio just a bit earlier.
I spent about 10 years in archives in Germany and the United States, and I watched around 400 Hollywood feature films. And most of the dealings that I describe in the book were secret dealings, were dealings between Nazi officials and Hollywood studio executives that took place all through the 1930s. The Nazi German consul in Los Angeles was routinely invited to studio lots in Los Angeles and would be screened movies. And he would be asked, he would tell studio heads what scenes they needed to cut out of the movies if they wanted to keep their German business. And these cuts took place not just in Germany, but all around the world, including the United States.
But of course, you know, Germany back then would have been a far more important export market for Hollywood because, well, the world was a different place back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, Germany had been the second biggest export market for Hollywood movies before the First World War. It had dwindled slightly in the 1930s. And one of the more chilling discoveries I made was that the studios were mostly staying in Germany because they were worried that if they left and if Hitler started a European war and if Hitler conquered European territories, which he did, and they'd left Germany, then they would also be forced to leave other countries that he conquered. And even as late as 1940, when the Hollywood studios finally left Germany, they made statements to the press to the effect that maybe in the future Hitler will allow us to operate here under different conditions, meaning that he would win the war.
Quite interesting, because of course Hollywood has long had a long history with Jewish Americans in the country, and one of the arguments is that Hollywood producers simply ignored the problem of what was happening to Europe's Jews, including those American Jews in Hollywood. How could they be doing that?
Well, in fact, I discovered that almost from the moment that Hitler came to power in May of 1933, the screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz, who was Jewish, Herman Mankiewicz later wrote Citizen Kane. He came up with an idea to write a screenplay about Hitler's persecution of Jews in Germany. And when he did this, the Nazi German consul in Los Angeles threatened to expel all of the Hollywood studios from Germany if any of them made this picture. And Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM, the biggest American studio, soon said, "We have tremendous profits in Germany, and as far as I'm concerned, this picture will never be made." And so that set the precedent for the entire decade.
But how come after the war, then, none of these Hollywood studios were held accountable for any of their actions?
They actually went out of their way to rewrite history. So in 1941, an investigation was held in the United States Senate, and Daryl Zanuck, the head of 20th Century Fox, said, "When Hitler and Mussolini came to power, what was the first thing they did? They threw us out of Germany. They wanted no American movies in Germany. They wanted no part of the American way of life." But his own studio had been doing business in 1940, just the previous year. And so really, from the very beginning, Hollywood tried to rewrite history and to act as if they had not done business in Germany. And this is a fact that people really haven't known until now, that Hollywood movies were extremely popular in Nazi Germany all through the 1930s.
To tar Hollywood all with the same brush is a bit like tarring the media all with the same brush. I mean, I just wonder, was this a uniform approach by all the major studios, or were some more reluctant to do business?
When I use the word Hollywood, I mean the major Hollywood studios, not Hollywood the city or something like that. But no, this was a unified decision by all of the major Hollywood studios. In 1933, they followed the instructions of the propaganda ministry and collectively fired half of their Jewish salesmen in Germany. By 1936, they'd fired all of their Jewish salesmen, and they all collectively agreed not to make pictures about Hitler's persecution of Jews in Germany in order to maintain their business in Germany. And from 1936 to 1940, the three biggest Hollywood studios, MGM, Paramount, 20th Century Fox, all did business in Germany. Paramount and 20th Century Fox made pro-Nazi newsreels. And in the most shocking discovery I made after 10 years of research, MGM even financed the production of German armaments from December 1938 onwards.
Now, Ben, the book is called The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with Hitler. You have been criticized in some circles for using that word collaboration, because it is a very strong word. Do you think those criticisms are fair?
I don't, simply because that word collaboration was the word that both Nazi officials and studio executives used all through the 1930s to describe their relationship with each other. And as a historian, I have to be faithful to the language of the time.
But is there a danger that something's been lost in translation here? I mean, we're talking about what the Germans would call Zusammenarbeit, which literally means working together. I mean, collaboration has far more cynical undertones when it's translated into the English language.
Right, but the Americans also used the term collaboration. They didn't use the word working together or cooperation. The actual English word collaboration was systematically used all through the 1930s. And the word Zusammenarbeit was, of course, used to describe Vichy France in the 1940s. So the word Zusammenarbeit is the equivalent of collaboration in English.
And you said you've kind of studied this for over the last 10 years.
That's right.
How did you get access to so much of this, I guess, hidden information in a sense?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Germany, and no Hollywood historians had ever looked at any German archives. And these are materials that were publicly available, but that historians had not thought to look at. And so what I did was I went through files of Hitler's personal adjutants in Berlin and files of all of the German consulates and embassies around the world from 1930 to 1945. And I discovered that these were secret dealings that the Nazis had recorded very carefully in their materials. of their dealings with studio executives. The Hollywood studio files are more limited and probably kept up under lock and key somewhere on studio lots. I didn't have access to many of those, but there were some interesting files that I did have access to, but it was the German materials that I uncovered.
I suppose the sad thing about all this is it really all comes down to money, doesn't it? I mean, I'm not sure if you've unearthed any evidence of Hollywood studios actually sympathising with what Hitler wanted to do. I won't presume that you have not, or correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, Germany, as you pointed out, would have been their second biggest market, and if the Germans weren't going to let a movie in, well, then that movie wasn't going to make money.
Right. Well, the primary motive was obviously profits, and that is, again, not my language. That's the language of the studio executives at the time. Louis B. Mayer said, "We have tremendous profits in Germany. As far as I'm concerned, this picture will never be made," meaning a picture about Hitler's persecution of the Jews. And I found no evidence that they had any other motive.
They're movie makers. They weren't journalists, though.
No, and they were operating like other American businesses in Germany, and they were no different from companies like IBM or General Motors. But they did have the opportunity from the very beginning to show what Hitler was doing to Jews, and they had a specific movie script that they all read. And because of the interventions of Nazi officials, they decided that they were not going to make that kind of picture. And that kind of picture, I can't predict what it would have done, but it certainly would have mobilized public
and
opinion.
Ben, just very, very quickly, any reaction from the studios today?
The actual studio heads have made no comment on the book.
And that was Ben Irwand, author of The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with Hitler, with Monocle's Phil Hahn and Tig Enright. Time now for a song. We just heard about Hollywood's somewhat sordid wartime past, so staying on the theme just a little bit, here's Hollywood by Connie Francis.
Whose jalopy is covered with junk, but don't have any money for lunch? It's Hollywood.
And that was Hollywood by Connie Francis. Up next, we'll see what's happening on tonight's Monocle Daily. Stay tuned. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, and we're fast approaching the end of the program. But before we go, let's have a look at what's coming up on tonight's programs. Tom Lewis is with me, producer of the Monocle Daily this evening.
Good evening, Nancy. How are you?
I'm very well. You look busy and all fired up. You've got two shows this evening.
So two for the price of one for our listeners tonight on Monocle 24.
You're such a bargain.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. Oh. Nicest thing anyone's said to me all day, Nancy. So thank you very much indeed.
We'll have to revisit this conversation later, perhaps.
I think we will. I'd love to.
Take us into the tent of the story making up there. What have you got?
So tonight on The Globalist Asia, which airs at 20:00 hours London time, we'll be beginning with these twin explosions in northern China. So two homemade bombs, is what the reports are telling us so far, went off outside provincial headquarters of the Communist Party. No fatalities, thankfully, it seems, but a couple of injuries. And we are going to be looking at that. Actually, these explosions, it seems, are rare and are a shock, but actually the explosives are quite easy to get a hold of in China, it seems, because of the big coal mining industries. And actually, the reporter we've spoken to in China says that these maybe aren't as uncommon occurrences as we might think they are. So we'll be unpicking that later on The Globalist Asia.
Any idea of who?
Not yet. Okay. The speculation is rife, but obviously it's very early days and people are still coming to terms with the shock of these attacks in quite a sleepy area of China. So obviously this will be ongoing for the days and weeks to come.
We'd like to listen out for that, but time for just another little one, if you can.
Yes, so we'll be heading over to New Jersey for our lead story on the Monocle Daily, which airs at 2200 hours London time. Chris Christie, victorious in his re-election campaign. He now maybe looks set for a bid for the White House in 2016, so he'll be unpicking all of that later on the Monocle
Very
Daily.
Popular Republican.
Yes, he is, in quite a blue state, so we'll be unpicking that later, Nancy.
Excellent, Tom. Thanks so much for being here. And that's all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Zania Dormandy and Shashank Joshi. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Maddie Arouge, and our studio manager was Claire Urbon. Next after the headlines is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. This week we survey the business landscape in Egypt following the coup.
There's still very high inflation. There's still security issues. While it's a very cash-rich economy, and it's one issue, is that we don't over-egg the fact that people think that this is bad news in Egypt all the time. For most people, most of the time, life goes on as normal.
2000 hours tonight, London time, Globalist Asia. 2200 hours, London, The Monocle Daily. This show will be back tomorrow at the same time at 1800 London time. Thanks for listening. I'm Nancy Durham.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. One year can inspire a lifetime.